what they were saying when they think you cannot hear. If you understood what they do, if for you it was so clear. If you knew they shut down the factory in an economic ruse. If you could kiss the cheek of the child in the sweatshop that made your shoes. Every time we went to war to fight our evil foes, they told you we were really fighting for the good of CEOs. If you could feel the hunger of the many, see the riches of the few. If they told it like it is, what if you knew?
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, speaking truth to expose the forces of greed with Margaret Flowers. Clearing the Fog is a project of popularresistance.org. You can subscribe to it on Apple, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can also find Clearing the Fog at popularresistance.org. And while you're there, you can subscribe to the free Daily Digest. Each morning, you'll receive an email that has summaries of the articles posted the day before. This is a great way to keep up with movement news and analysis. So this week, I interviewed Dr. Feroz Sidwa about the conditions of the healthcare system in Gaza, as well as the case of Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya, who was abducted by the Israeli military. Dr. Sidwa is a general trauma and critical care surgeon in California. He's also a humanitarian surgeon, having worked most extensively in Palestine, but also in Ukraine, Haiti, Zimbabwe, and Burkina Faso. Dr. Sidwa, thank you so much for taking time to speak with me today.
Nice to be with you.
Today, I wanted to speak with you about Palestine. You've been there twice in the last 2 years to volunteer your skills there. And we now are 1,000 days into this phase of the genocide against Palestinians. I wanted to start out talking with you about your own experience. You first went to Palestine in 2004 after you graduated from school. Can you talk a little bit about what drew you to Palestine?
I started college in 2000, and in the first month of my university in Baltimore at Hopkins was when the second Intifada broke out, and I'd never heard of Israel or Palestine. My family is from India and Pakistan, and they're from a small ethnic and religious minority there. So that politically, it never came up in our house, and it was a pretty apolitical household anyway. But this second Intifada broke out, and I kind of sitting there looking around, and I can't figure out why everyone's so heated up about this. It was a big thing on campus. So, I started reading about it, and eventually I started to ask, okay, I get that all these people are getting hurt and killed, but why do we care here? Surely people get hurt all over the place. And then I was happened to walk through the Hopkins bookstore, and they had the new edition of Chomsky's Fateful Triangle had just been published. And the subtitle to that book is The United States, Israel, and the Palestinians. And so I said, oh, okay, that's exactly what I've been curious about. Like, why do Americans care about this? So I read it, and it's pretty hard to read that book and not remember it. If people haven't read it, they still should. It's very much still worthwhile. So that book makes very clear that the United States is intimately involved. It's really not even doesn't do it justice, but the U.S. is intimately involved in what's going on in the Middle East generally, and between Israel and the Palestinians specifically. And, as I developed kind of a political consciousness in college, of course, 9/11 happened the next year, then we invaded Afghanistan, we invaded Iraq. So in that time, I ended up learning a lot about the Israel-Palestine conflict. I ended up helping edit some of Norman Finkelstein's books on the topic. And I had gone to college thinking I would be a physician because my dad's a doctor. But at this point, I was questioning that, just thinking, oh, should I be a doctor? Maybe law would be better to help people. Who knows? You're young and don't really know what to do. So I found a volunteer spot in Israel, actually, in Haifa, working with a Palestinian Jewish cooperative in Haifa. So I went there. I lived there for about a year. And during that time, I would tour around in the West Bank, and I gravitated towards the physicians, Palestinians for sure, but also Israelis, especially people who were volunteering with Physicians for Human Rights Israel back then, because Jewish Israelis could still go into the Palestinian parts of the West Bank. And gravitating towards those physicians, I said, okay, well, I will go to med school. I will become a doctor. So since I kind of decided to be a doctor in Palestine, it's been kind of natural for me to keep going back there and for that to be the focus of my so-called international work. Yeah.
Right. So you were there before the real lockdown of Gaza, which began in 2007. When you went back in 2024, of course, now this is a year or almost a year into the escalation of the genocide. How were things different between those two experiences?
I never went to the Gaza Strip when I was there in 2004 and 2005. I tried, but they wouldn't let me cross the Erez border. So I haven't been in Gaza before I entered there in 2024. But if anybody wants to know the details of how Gaza changed before 2007 and after, there's two books that you should read. Both of them happen to be by American Jewish professors, actually. The first is called The Gaza Strip, The Political Economy of Dedevelopment. And make sure you pick up the third edition of it, which is, I think, came out in 2016, if I remember. It's by a professor at Harvard named Sarah Roy. She's certainly the world's leading expert, or at least the Western world's leading expert on the Gaza Strip. She lived there for many years, knows a lot of people there, and she's an economist by training. And the other is Norman Finkelstein's book, Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom. Those two books really illustrate what the 2007 blockade or siege or whatever you want to call it of Gaza that was implemented in 2007, what it did to that place. But if anyone doesn't know, just after barely a year of the siege being implemented, so in 2008, Mary Robinson, who was the former president of Ireland, and she used to work with Jimmy Carter and people like that, Desmond Tutu, she went to Gaza, and when she left, she told CNN that, and I'm quoting her exactly, their whole civilization has been destroyed. I'm not exaggerating. It's almost unbelievable that the world doesn't care about this while it's happening. She said that after 1 year of the blockade, and now we're going on 20 years. And in addition to 13 military operations and all sorts of other insanity. So it's quite a thing that's been done to Gaza. And there's really, people think I'm exaggerating when I say that there's nothing like this being done to anybody anywhere else in the world, but there really isn't.
Yeah, I was wondering because you have been to other places and other war zones. How did this compare to what you've seen?
Yeah, Gaza is a completely different thing. I've been in Ukraine. I've been in Burkina Faso, which has a there's a civil war in Burkina Faso. It's part of the Central Sahel crisis. But I've worked in southern Zimbabwe, which is kind of a low-level conflict zone. I've worked in Haiti, which is a simmering conflict zone. But Gaza is just a completely different thing. In Ukraine, it's not like children don't get killed in Ukraine. No, nobody should pretend that. The war between Russia and Ukraine is extremely brutal. But to understand the difference in level between what's going on in Gaza and what's going on in Ukraine, if anybody wants to read like a lot of detail about this, I wrote a three-part piece for Zatteo on this. Just search for Feroz Sid with Zatteo, and it's the first thing that comes up. If anybody doesn't have access to Zatteo, because it's a paid thing, just send me an email. I can send you the PDFs. It's no big deal. So there's a lot of detail in those pieces comparing Gaza to other major conflict zones, especially Syria and Ukraine. But just to take one example that happened just a few days ago, Kyiv, which is the biggest city in Ukraine, is a city of 3 million people. So it's about 1.5 times bigger than Gaza in terms of population, but also in land mass. It's actually larger than the entire Gaza Strip. And the most intense bombardment, at least according to Zelensky, I think he's exaggerating to be fair, but according to Zelensky, the most intense Russian bombardment of Kyiv happened just a few days ago now. I think it's Thursday now, it must have been Monday. And in that bombardment, 20 civilians were killed. Now, that's obviously 20 too many. That's horrible. But every day in Gaza, 200 to 300 people were being killed. There's no comparison. And furthermore, a third of them are children, a third of them are women. Of the adults that are killed, 5 or 10% are elderly. There's very few people who would even qualify as being suspected of being a combatant. Again, if anybody wants the details on this, please look at that Zatteo piece or it references plenty of other literature. Of the men of combatant age or combat age males, it's kind of a dehumanizing term, but nevertheless, it's the one that's used. Of the combat age males, it's very clear that the vast majority of them were civilians as well. The number I was able to come up with is that anywhere between 85 and 95% of the deaths in Gaza were almost certainly civilian deaths. That's just outrageous. There's no war zone where that happens. Our firebombing of Germany didn't do that. Our firebombing of Tokyo didn't do that. The use of atomic weapons in Hiroshima didn't do that. That's typical of genocide. And this talk happened after I published my Zatteo piece. But if anybody's interested, Michael Spagat, who's one of the there's a few people in the epidemiology world. He's actually a political scientist, but in that epidemiology world who study conflict epidemiology very closely, he gave a long talk. I forget for which group, but again, anybody just you send me an email and I can send you the link because it's a public talk. He gave a long talk comparing Gaza explicitly to other recognized genocides. And he shows that the demographic pattern of who was killed in Gaza fits right into the middle of the genocide cluster, not the war cluster. So there's no doubt that there's a war going on in Gaza. Obviously, the Israelis are attacking and Hamas is fighting back, and so are other armed groups. But there's also something else going on, and that's not going on in many other places. what's going on in Gaza is much more similar to what was done to Al-Fasher by the rapid support forces backed by us and the UAE than it is to what's going on between Russia and Ukraine.
Yeah. And I don't think it's any secret that this is a genocide and that the Zionists would like to completely displace the Palestinians from their land. When you came back from, I can't remember if it was your first or second trip, you were with Dr. Perlmutter and you spoke on Democracy Now! And you talked about how the difference there also in how the children were targeted. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was after our first trip. So I try to be careful. I can't tell you in the case of any particular child that they were targeted by Israel for deliberate killing. But what we witnessed when we were in Gaza, and it's not just me and Mark, I wrote a New York Times article about this, in asking, it was basically a study of what 65 American healthcare workers who have worked in the Gaza Strip saw while they were there. I don't remember the exact number, but I think about 83% of us saw small children shot in the head or the chest on a regular basis. So we're not talking about 17 and a half year old boys. We're talking about prepubescent children, preteenage children. So when Mark and I, this was after our first trip, this was March and April of 2024. During that time, there were Israeli ground troops in Khan Yunis, and the hospital we were at, European Hospital, was on the eastern edge of that city. So while we were there, there were Israeli ground troops there, and we saw children shot regularly. Like for me, I recorded in my diary that I saw 13 kids shot in the 14 days that I was there, shot in the head or the chest. I probably saw more, but I didn't write it down because there were times when hands were just covered in blood and couldn't write something down, or I was just too tired to do it or whatever. But so when I came back, Ralph Nader's office actually contacted me, and Ralph Nader's, the thing he does all day is write letters to the President of the United States. And he suggested that I do the same thing and to explain what I had seen in Gaza, because I think he saw me on Democracy Now! As well. And, I thought to myself, it doesn't make sense if I write a letter myself. Like, who am I? I'm just one guy. But if I get a bunch of, dozens of American healthcare workers who've worked in Gaza to sign this letter as well, that's very unusual. It's not common for dozens of American healthcare workers to write a letter to the President of the United States saying that we saw atrocities committed with our own eyes by American weapons, by an American ally. That's very uncommon. So we did that. I think we had 44 or 45 signatures on it, and we sent this letter to Biden and Harris. Of course, they didn't agree to have a meeting with us or anything else. But in that letter, one of the things we mentioned was that we saw small children shot in the head on a regular, if not daily, basis. So that the New York Times visual investigation team, they saw this and they got interested, and so they contacted me. So I polled 65 American healthcare workers and asked them the same thing. And like I said, 83% who had worked in the Gaza Strip said the same thing. So it's very hard. If a military expert can explain this to me, and I've asked several and they can't, if a military expert can explain to me how it's possible that in the catchment area of every hospital in the Gaza Strip, for at that point over a year, anytime there are Israeli ground troops present, every single day, small children are shot in the head and the chest and brought to the hospital. Could one child get shot in the head in a crossfire or during a battle of some kind? Yeah, sure. Could a few children be shot by some Hamas crazy person who thinks that this is going to solve the Israeli? I'll blame the Israelis. Yeah, it's possible. But that cannot possibly explain a pattern with hundreds of recurring instances throughout the Gaza Strip, throughout time, and on a daily recurring basis. That's obviously being done by the Israeli army, not by Hamas or Islamic Jihad or anything. It just requires a level of racist lunacy to believe that that could possibly be done exclusively by Hamas. That's just absurd, So it's, I can't comment on individual cases. That's for journalists and human rights investigators to do, which is why they're not allowed into the Gaza Strip. But what I can comment on is the vast, consistent, almost without exception pattern that the people who have absolutely no reason to lie are reporting. If what we reported is actually happening, it just requires you to believe that Palestinians are just all genetically psychotic and hate their own children, to believe that they could be doing this to themselves. And there's only one other party with guns in the Gaza Strip. That's the Israeli army.
Yeah, and I think if you're familiar with Abby Martin and Mike Preisner did a film, Gaza Fights for Freedom, based on the 2018 march, I guess it
The
was called
March
the
of the
Great
Great
March
March of
of
Return,
Return, right? And I think they documented in there that the Israeli snipers were targeting children
Yeah,
in that, which was a nonviolent action.
yeah, and so this is a very, very important point. I'm really glad you said that. This is a very important point. Nothing that is being done to Gaza right now is new. Nothing. Not the destruction of apartment buildings, not the destruction of the power plant, not the destruction of the water system, not the destruction of the sewage system, not the shooting of children and pregnant women, literally nothing. it's all been turned up to 11, that's for sure. It was never done at this scale, but none of it is new. You can go back to B'Tselem is the major Israeli human rights organization. There's plenty of others too. Yeah. Yesh Din, Public Committee Against Torture in Israel, and there's lots of them. But B'Tselem, I think, has the most extensive reporting on what's called the open fire policy that Israel adheres to in the West Bank. In other words, when can soldiers open fire? And the answer is anytime they like. That's B'Tselem's conclusion. That predates October 7th by 20 years. You know, and you go back to the first intifada, you go all the way through the so-called Oslo years, the 90s, basically. You go through the second intifada, you go through the end of the second intifada, and all the way up until today, the open fire policy remains the same. Soldiers are almost never punished for even the most reckless and crazed and completely unnecessary opening of fire in civilian areas. They're almost never punished for the killing of children. They're almost never punished for the shooting of women, et cetera. Not that the shooting of men is okay. Please don't misunderstand me. But these are just totally unquestionable cases of deliberate killing, and soldiers are never punished for them. Even when they are punished for them, they get ludicrously light sentences, you know, 2 months in the brig or something like that. And oftentimes they just get a mild demotion. People might remember it was March 23rd of 2025. There was a major incident. I think it's called Tel Sultan. It's on the western side of what used to be Rafah. That night, I think it was 2 or 3 or 4 in the morning, but certainly when the sun was down, that night, an Israeli unit, which was lying in ambush because they were planning on carrying out a surprise attack in the morning. They were lying secretly. You know, they were just camouflaged off the road. And that night, that unit killed 15 ambulance workers, a UN employee, and what the Palestinians call civil defense people, what we would call first responders, like firefighters. At first, they said that this convoy of ambulances approached suspiciously, didn't have their lights on. They got out of their vehicles and charged the Israeli soldiers and all sorts of made up nonsense. Well, after this massacre, the Israelis buried all of these bodies and actually even crushed their vehicles with bulldozers and tried to bury their vehicles as well, or kind of obscure them with dirt. And what they didn't realize is that one of the ambulance drivers had recorded the whole thing on his cell phone, and they buried his cell phone with him. Well, about a week later, the Israelis allowed the UN to go exhume these bodies and bury them properly. And they found this phone. And so the Palestine Red Crescent Society published the footage, which showed that everything the Israelis had said was a lie. Everything. Everybody was walking away from the Israeli position when the Israelis opened fire on them. They all had their lights on. It was a huge convoy. It was easily visible from anywhere. So then the New York Times, which, you know, is a pretty bad newspaper, in my opinion, even though I've published there, the New York Times doesn't like being lied to, and it doesn't like having egg on its face. So they kind of did more of an inquiry, and they found, yeah, that's true. There were plenty of audio analyses that came out. One was by Forensic Architecture, I think. There were plenty of them. I think the Washington Post might have done one as well. Plenty of audio analyses of this murdered man's video recording of his own murder. And they all found that the Israeli soldiers were rapidly charging the Palestinians while shooting at them. And they found that I don't remember if most or half or some large number of them were shot at point blank range in the head. They were executed. Okay. So literally all of this was a lie. And then actually, this is really, so then the Israelis opened a new inquiry. They said, oh, well, there's new information. How can we, you know, we were mistaken before. The Israelis then held a press conference to show the whole world how transparent they are, how careful we are. And they showed the gathered press drone footage of the incidents, meaning they knew exactly what had happened. They knew full well their soldiers were lying. Somebody pointed out to them, apparently, I think during the press conference, they said the drone footage doesn't match what you're saying right now at all. Like you're saying the drone shows X, but it actually shows Y. And this went further. Haaretz actually, I think it was Nir Hasson at Haaretz, which is Israel's major newspaper, showed that actually the Israelis had taken the commander of that unit to the West Bank, to a military base there, and they had forced him to reconstruct the entire scene and found that he was lying. They knew he was lying. In other words, this was all just BS. They knew that these people were, they knew that their soldiers were lying to them. They decided to go with it anyway, and they only got called out on this because this poor guy had recorded his own murder, and they were too careless to think of that and destroy the Palestinian cell phones instead of burying them. I'm sure they won't make that mistake again. So this is like executing ambulance workers is insane. I don't mean to be calloused here, but that's something you think of the Nazis doing. That's not something you think of a civilized country doing. This is outrageous behavior. So nothing the Israelis are doing is new, and it's just been turned up to 11. Ambulance crews have been killed by the Israelis for a very long time, not only in Gaza but in the West Bank, in southern Lebanon, and plenty of other places. It's just, now we have the benefit of cell phones, but you wonder what benefit it actually is, because even though everybody can see these things open with their eyes, it's not hard to figure out. Even the New York Times published on it, but policy stays the same. And
Right.
that's a political problem. It's clearly not a problem of information being available.
Yeah, I think if anything, what's happening in Palestine right now has really exposed to the world the failures of our international institutions and our international states. I mean, there are very few countries that are actually following their obligations under the Genocide Convention. I think, Yemen is one that is taking that seriously. Spain is starting to. But so much of what is happening right now defies international law. You mentioned there are very few media people in Gaza. We know that, hundreds of press members have been murdered by the Israelis. That's been happening with impunity. And I'm wondering, as a medical professional, because typically, throughout centuries, health professionals were considered neutral members. If there's a conflict going on, health professionals are protected. They serve and treat whoever's injured. Doesn't matter what your politics are, what your side is. There's been kind of this standard, this ethic. How did you see that when you were in Gaza? What was happening?
So the first Geneva Convention ever signed was in 1864, which, just in case sometimes we don't have good historical, a way of orienting ourselves in that, and for such a long time ago. In 1864, the American Civil War was still going on. Like that's how long ago this was. Like,
Right.
slavery was an open question in America still. So in 1864, the first Geneva Convention was signed, and it is specifically about not obstructing and, in fact, facilitating the work of military healthcare providers. Healthcare providers in opposing militaries should not be targeted for killing as long as they don't participate in combat, even if there aren't, but as long as they don't participate in combat, as long as they are designated as military healthcare workers, which is where, as long as they have some sort of patch like the Red Cross or Red Crescent patch. Healthcare facilities, unless they're actually used to contribute to combat in some way, should not actually be targeted. Again, even military healthcare facilities should not be targeted. These rules got updated all the way through the Geneva Conventions of 1949, the ones that were written after World War II and after the Nazi Holocaust. And so in the it's got to be the Fourth Geneva Convention. In the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949, I think it's Article 20 that mostly goes through what healthcare workers' protections are. I wrote an article about this with Leonard Rubinstein for an online publication called Think Global Health, if anybody wants the details. A healthcare worker, anybody who's participating in the care of either civilians or even combatants who are wounded and are no longer participating in combat, the healthcare workers themselves are protected people. The patients obviously are protected people. Even wounded combatants are protected people. They cannot be targeted for killing. That's not how it works. And you can kind of realize why if you go back to the origin of this. So in 1864, I forget the name of this fellow who did this, but a businessman went to negotiate something with Napoleon. And somewhere in Central Europe, he met Napoleon on a battlefield after a battle. And he was trying to negotiate this business deal, but he's looking out over the battlefield that Napoleon had just won. And Napoleon's men are going around and just murdering everybody who's wounded but still alive from the opposing side. And the guy is looking out saying, "My God, is this how every battle ends?" He said, "Yeah, of course. And why would we leave these people alive?" And this businessman said, "Right, but I mean, the battle's over. You won. Why do you have to kill them? Like, they're just young men fighting for their country." And he, "Well, this is how we do it." So the guy was so horrified that he left the meeting and went to the local town, like the town that was nearby, organized people there and said, "Look, these are just young men. They were just, the battle's over. They lost. They surrendered. There's no reason to murder them." And so the townspeople actually went out and told Napoleon to kind of stop, and they started bandaging up these people's wounds. And that was where this came from originally. So that's the reason that you're not allowed to kill people who are wounded and are no longer participating in combat. They're called hors de combat. They've been taken out of combat. So yes, the healthcare facilities are protected, healthcare providers are protected, and the wounded patients are protected, right? So that's the situation. I think everybody knows that the killing of healthcare workers in Gaza, there's no precedent for this in human history. I don't, to be fair, I don't know about the time of Genghis Khan or something like that, but there's no precedent for this in history. I'm writing a paper about this right now for Medicine, Conflict, and Survival, but the rate of killing of healthcare workers in the Gaza Strip is literally hundreds of times higher than it is in Ukraine. And Ukraine, before from February 2022, when Russia invaded mainland Ukraine, to October 2023, when this round of fighting in Gaza started, in that time, Ukraine was the deadliest conflict for healthcare workers in the world. So that's how bad it was. And Gaza is literally orders of magnitude worse. This is just outrageous. I mean, it's very hard to fathom this. And I'll just give you a personal story. Also on March 23rd, it just happens to be the same day as the killings in Tel Sultan that I mentioned before. I always remember the date because it's my sister's birthday. On that day, there was a boy named Ibrahim that I had operated on 5 days before. He had been injured by a bombing in his tent. His colon had been injured. I stopped him from bleeding and had to give him a colostomy. That's where your intestines come out to your skin so your insides can heal. So this kid had a colostomy, but he was actually healing up quite well. He's a 16-year-old boy. He was quite healthy. He was malnourished like everybody else, but relatively healthy. He actually hadn't developed an infection or anything like that, and he was actually ready to go home on the evening of the 23rd. But it was Ramadan, and I didn't want to send him home in the middle of the night because everybody's celebrating this the evening meal called iftar with whatever food they could actually find. And so I said, forget it. I'll discharge him in the morning. But so I said, okay, I'm going to go down to his room. Which was on the second floor. We lived on the fourth floor. I'll just go down to his room and change his bandages one last time, explain to him one last time how to take care of the colostomy, which he already kind of knew, but just reinforcing things, make sure that he knew he would go to his tent in the morning. To make a long story short, on my way down to his room, the Israelis fired a drone-fired missile directly into his room. Now they bragged about this. There was no ambiguity about it. There wasn't a whole bunch of bombing on the street, and one bomb just happened to go. No, they just specifically targeted his room. Now they did it to kill the other guy in the room, whose name was Ismail Barhum. They had the same last name because I think they were distant cousins, from what I gathered from speaking to other people afterwards. And because they were distantly related, Gazan families are very large. You can go, here we would call them clans, so they're called just extended families. Because they were both part of the Barhum family, the nurses put them in the same room. Well, the Israelis claimed that they fired that missile because they wanted to kill Ismail, the 55-year-old man in the room, who was also an admitted patient. Because they said that he was the prime minister of Gaza and that he was in the hospital planning terrorist attacks. Now, this is completely leaving aside that just murdering the prime minister of a country is not legal. Leaving aside that killing him when he's wounded in a hospital is doubly illegal. Leaving aside, there's just so many compounding things going on here. But that bombing almost killed me. I was about 90 seconds away from being in his room. So, this whole thing is just completely insane. And again, I'm not more important than Ibrahim. I don't want anybody to think that I'm claiming such a thing. That would be very ugly. But that's, it's just, it's crime on top of crime on top of crime on top of crime. First of all, even if he was not, but just to be clear, even if Ismail Barhum was a legitimate military target, he wasn't even a military target to start with. He's, if you say he's, I don't know, I don't think he knew he was the prime minister of Gaza. I'm pretty sure they're making that up. But even if he was the prime minister of Gaza, that does not make him a military target. That's ludicrous. Like, no one thinks President Trump is a military target. Nobody thinks Prime Minister Netanyahu is a military target. Both of these people are intimately involved in the military decision-making of their countries, but they're not military targets. That's just the way it is, right? Or that's the way it's supposed to be. If these people want to keep changing this, they might regret it later. But regardless of that, so number one, he's not a military target, but he's attacked anyway and wounded. Fine. Number two, even if he was a military target, now he's hors de combat, admitted to a hospital. So now he's definitely not only is he not a military target, he is a specifically protected person under international humanitarian law, under the Fourth Geneva Conventions, which were created specifically to criminalize the acts of the Nazis in occupied Europe. Just everybody should keep in mind what laws are actually being violated here. Number three, even if it was legitimate to kill him, there is no possible way that firing an explosive warhead into a hospital can ever be a proportionate use of force. storming the hospital and shooting him in the head. Again, I don't agree with it. I'm not, that shouldn't have happened, and it didn't happen. Using a drone to fire a bullet into him. Okay, that at least would be a proportional use of force. It still would have been illegal for the other two reasons I mentioned, but it's, firing an explosive device into a hospital is insane. There's no way that can be proportional. Fourth, they recklessly killed the 16-year-old boy who is also a protected person in this hospital. Fifth, they almost killed me, a healthcare worker, and in effect, an international volunteer. And sixth, they destroyed the entire surgical ward, taking about 25 beds in a 200-bed hospital out of service. So, again, that's like six crimes all in one.
Right.
So that's just, and that's one moment. It's literally one moment in Gaza. It's completely outrageous. And if people don't, I mean, I'm guessing listeners of your show do understand this, but Gaza's healthcare is like kind of like I mentioned with the killing of healthcare workers. This article will come out in Medicine, Conflict, and Survival, hopefully in the next few months. Just comparing the attacks on healthcare in Ukraine and Gaza, they're just orders of magnitude different. I mean, it's, and again, the attacks on healthcare in Ukraine are dastardly, they are criminal, they are evil, they are psychotic, and they don't even remotely compare to what's going on in Gaza. So what does that say about what again? And I just have to stress, it's not the Israelis doing these things to Gaza. It is us. We are the ones, and the Israelis are also doing it, obviously, but we are the ones doing this to Gaza. American airplanes are burning American jet fuel to drop American bombs outfitted with American guidance systems on Gaza. That's what's going on. There might be Stars of David painted on the airplanes, but that's purely a technicality.
Right. And I think you've made that point publicly as well, that the United States has to stop its support for this.
We'll take a short musical break and return to the interview with Dr. Feroz Sidwa.
Every day we tell each other that this day will be the last, and tomorrow we all can go home free, and all this will finally end. Palestine, tomorrow will be free.
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, speaking truth Palestine, to expose the forces of greed with Margaret Flowers. And now we'll return to the interview with Dr. Feroz Sidwa in progress.
It's not just the military, as you said, it's the political cover, the diplomatic cover, financial, providing weapons, it's everything.
Everything,
One thing that's becoming very urgent right now is the condition of Dr. Husam Abu Safia. He was the director of Kamal Adwan Hospital. I think it was December of 2024. He was abducted by the Israeli military, put into prison. And now we know his condition there, which we knew was he was being treated severely. Now I think there are concerns about his life. Can you talk a little bit about Dr. Abu Safia?
Yeah, so I've never met Hussam. I wish I had had the opportunity to, but I've never met him. Hussam Abu Safia is a pediatrician and neonatologist in northern Gaza, like you mentioned, at Kamal Adwan Hospital, which is on the eastern side of Gaza City. And when he was taken by the Israeli military, the hospital had been under siege for, I believe, 3 months at that point. It was completely crazy. Again, even if there was some legitimate military purpose to attacking the hospital, laying siege to it is just, there's just no way that that can be turned into a proportional attack. It's just outrageous. But Dr. Hussam had been in Kamal Adwan Hospital before when it was laid siege to as well. Forget the exact months, but I want to say it was March and April of 2024, but I could be wrong. I hope people won't hold me to that if I'm incorrect about it. But what is correct for sure is that at that time, he was arrested by the Israelis. He was interrogated and he was promptly released. They said, this guy is obviously not a threat to anybody. Let him go back to work. Okay, fine. Well, now December of 2024 rolls around. And all of a sudden, they've discovered that Hussam Abu Safia is actually a colonel in Hamas. Okay, that's kind of odd. When exactly does he do this? Like, when does he, how does one go about being a colonel in Hamas and working in a hospital that's working at 300% capacity as a pediatrician living in a society that is half children? But when exactly does he have time to go around being a Hamas colonel? I mean, this is completely ridiculous. It's just on its face absurd, right? It's so transparently absurd that the fact that it's reported by, like the BBC had a brief update about Hussein Abu Safia a few days ago. To be fair, at least they said his name. But two-thirds of the three-minute report was about Israel's allegations against him, which are just transparently idiotic. You know, like just not even mentioning how completely and utterly absurd these claims are.
Yeah.
Well, so yeah, so Hussein Abu Safia, he's living and trying to survive through the siege of Kamal Adwan Hospital, going from, I guess, about September to December of 2024. And during that time, his son is killed, I believe, in the hospital, I believe by a drone strike. He buries his son in the courtyard of the hospital, but he continues working. And he himself is wounded by shrapnel, I believe, in his leg. He continues working. And finally, the Israeli siege forces outside issue him an ultimatum. Either you come out and surrender to us, or we're going to invade and destroy the hospital. So he comes out and surrenders. And of course, then they invade and rip the hospital to shreds anyway. So he surrenders to them. He calmly, in his white coat, walks up to, I don't know if it's a tank or an armored personnel carrier or what, literally just knocks on the door outside, and they pull him inside, and he's never heard from again. For several months, he's disappeared. The Israelis won't even say where he is. Finally, he surfaces. I think at first he was at Ofer prison in the West Bank, but I don't remember.
Okay. Again, I think he was at, was it that. Seidman, S-D-E?
I don't know if he was taken to Sidi Tamon or not, but it doesn't matter because they're all torture camps. If anybody wants to read about Israel's, what B'Tselem literally calls Israel's network of torture camps, they've written two really, really hard reports to read. One, the first is called Welcome to Hell, and the second is called Living Hell. They're really genuinely shocking, if anybody wants to know what actually happens in these places. But so I don't remember which. I don't know that he was taken to Sidi Tamon, just because I think he was actually in the Israeli prison system, and that's a military facility, but it doesn't matter.
Okay.
Eventually, he is taken to this, I think it's pronounced Rekafat, area of a different prison. Now, this prison was actually shut down, at least that area of the prison. It's completely underground, 24-hour lockdown, no sunlight, no nothing. It was originally built to hold Israel's organized crime people, but it was shut down in the 1980s after a huge human rights scandal. Well, Itamar Ben-Gvir, the political opposition in Israel, describes him as a Jewish fascist, and I think that's accurate. It's a direct quote from Yair Lapid. But Ben-Gvir reopens it and, of course, stocks it with all of his most hated people, which are the Palestinians from Gaza. So now Hussein appears to be being tortured and beaten literally on a daily basis. He's being starved. He's lost a good amount of weight. I read recently that he's lost 24 kilos. I don't know how anybody knew that exact number, but it's, I mean, you know, like most Palestinians, he was a little bit chubby before he went into prison. Now he's extremely thin. His hair has gone from salt and pepper to shock gray. And the last visual evidence that we have of him is a recording that one of his lawyers made in court of him on a video screen. And he just looks absolutely terrible. This was several months ago. The most recent time his lawyer saw him, he wasn't able to record him, but he said he didn't actually recognize him when the camera turned on. He said he's got bruising all throughout his face and head, and he's just speaking in these fatalist terms, saying, "They brought me here to kill me. I can see the end. I'm going to die. I'm already dead. I think he said, "I don't think of myself as being alive anymore." Again, it's just his life is in imminent danger. Now, because of that, there is a big push. There's a big petition or several petitions. Avaz has a petition going around. I think Physicians for Human Rights Israel has a petition going around. An Israeli-American who's a very dedicated guy, a really impressive gentleman named Naftali Kamensky, I think is his last name, who is a pulmonologist at Yale, is circulating a petition for healthcare workers. Amnesty International has commented on his case. The UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention just issued a report on his case. All sorts of people are trying to bring attention to the fact that he's at imminent risk of death.
Right.
And he's one of 14 healthcare workers who are still in Israeli prisons. And that's not including the several bodies of Palestinian healthcare workers that are still being held in Israeli prisons.
Right.
For example, Dr. Adnan Al-Bursh, who was actually a world-renowned orthopedic surgeon. He was certainly the most famous doctor in the Gaza Strip. He was taken, I forget from which hospital. I don't think it was the Siege of Shifa, but maybe it was. But he was taken from one of the hospitals in Gaza City. And by multiple accounts from released Palestinians, he was tortured and actually raped to death. He was sodomized with batons until it caused such bad internal bleeding that he was taken to the hospital. He died there. And his body is still being held in a refrigerator, probably in Ofer prison. The Israelis refused to release it to his family. Interestingly, he joins several dozen Palestinian bodies that are being held. The oldest, I think, is from 1964, that the Israelis still refuse to repatriate to his family. You know, there are actually, again, the Geneva Conventions makes this explicitly illegal, but it doesn't matter because powerful people get to do whatever they want. And just to give people a sense of what is actually going on in the Israeli prison system generally, Itamar Ben-Gvir is Israel's Minister of National Security. He also seems to be one of the front runners for Israel's in an election season right now. And early polling shows that he has a good chance of becoming the next prime minister of Israel, which is absolutely terrifying. Itamar Ben-Gvir is described by Yair Lapid, who again is one of the leaders of the Israeli opposition. The words he uses are, his exact term was, a dangerous Jewish fascist. Those are pretty strong words in a Jewish society to call somebody a fascist, you know, although it's becoming a badge of pride, actually. But under Itamar Ben-Gvir, what he has done to the Israeli prison system is really shocking. It was always a neglectful prison system, far worse than the American one, which is pretty bad, but somewhat comparable to something that you would find in North Korea. It was always at about that level, but now it's just an absolutely standalone international scandal. Just to give one example, there's a young man, I think his name was Wissan Ahmad, but I might have it wrong. I might have his exact name wrong, and I apologize for that, but this boy was from the West Bank, and he was 17 years old when he was taken into an Israeli prison. I think it was about 6 months later, he dies. The Israelis' own autopsy shows and says in writing that he was being starved. So now, for people who don't maybe understand this, if you die while being starved, you died of starvation. Those are the same thing. Most people who die of starvation don't literally, you know this as well as I do, but just for people who might not, most people who die of starvation don't actually die from actual protein wasting leading to a heart attack. They usually die because their immune system was weakened because of a lack of protein and calories, and they couldn't fight off a simple infection that you or I wouldn't even notice. A simple pneumonia, a simple skin infection becomes sepsis and you die from that. So this child was starved to death in an Israeli prison. I know the comparison is crude, and I apologize to people for making it, but that is something you think of the Nazis doing. It's really, really shocking behavior to starve a 17-year-old boy to death in a prison. And that it's just very hard to explain that kind of behavior. And just to, again, illustrate where, like, you know, what level of where Israel is going. Recently, just a few days ago, actually, a judge decided that because the coroner's autopsy doesn't specifically say the child died of starvation, it just says that starvation was a contributing cause to his death, which again is actually the same thing. A judge said that because it doesn't specifically say he was starved to death, there is no need to even investigate his death. That's a judge. That's a legal person. saying that this is insanity, you know, that this is what Ben-Gvir has done to the Israeli prison system. It's really quite a thing.
And well, I think we heard some stories from the Global Samud Flotilla folks who were recently abducted and the treatment that they experienced. I'm so glad that they were willing to speak about it.
Yes, and directly at Ben-Gvir's hands. In fact, with him standing over them, gloating the now, you know, it's again, I don't want anyone to get the impression that one group of people's life or suffering is more important than another's. Obviously, that is not the case. But when the Samud Flotilla was taken, which again, crime upon crime upon crime, the blockade of Gaza is completely illegal. That's transparently obvious, even though a UN commission says otherwise. That's transparently illegal. And number two, these people were all taken in international waters. They weren't even taken in the blockade zone.
Right. So, right. Yeah.
This is just international piracy, which again, just to be clear, is not new for Israel. Israel has been committing piracy in international waters, mostly in the waters between Cyprus and Lebanon, since the 1970s, kidnapping people, taking them to Israel, and explicitly, I want to be clear, explicitly for the purpose of using their imprisonment in negotiations as what was called a bargaining chip in the Israeli court cases that eventually in the 1980s made this practice illegal. It continued anyway, but yeah. So like, you know, most people just call that hostage taking, right? So yeah, so the Samud Flotilla, the multiple people, I mean, actually, I think basically all of them reported being beaten for no reason. They obviously posed no threat to anybody. Multiple women have reported being sexually assaulted, many of them while being beaten, some of them just while just being sexually assaulted. I don't want to trigger people. I understand it's very, very hard to hear about sexual assault if you're a victim of it. So please just know what I'll say next is about that. But I think judging from her accent, she was Australian. I forget her name. I should remember it, but I forget her name. She was on the flotilla with her daughter. And this woman describes being taken into a shipping container, being grabbed and beaten from all sides, and then feeling something penetrate her vagina. She didn't know if it was a penis. She didn't know if it was someone's fingers, but something. What kind, this is an Australian person that you grabbed in international waters because they were trying to bring baby formula somewhere. Like maybe you, even if you think that they have no right to do it, even if they hate Israelis or hate Jews or something, who treats people this way? It's psychotic. Right. This is just not normal behavior. You know, another thing that has gotten a lot of press recently, and again, this is still about sexual violence, is the use of dogs to sexually assault people. Now, I've seen physicians, and I cannot believe that they have not gotten in trouble for this with the state boards that give them certifications to practice, because it's completely irresponsible for them to say things like that. I've seen physicians on, you know, just on Twitter or whatever, say, this is all nonsense. It's physically impossible. It's anatomically impossible for dogs to penetrate human beings. You know, this is all lies. These are all anti-Semitic lies. Well, first of all, there are multiple cases reported of this. Actually, the first cases that I know of are during the Nazi Holocaust, of dogs being trained to rape Jewish women, actually. So if you think they're lying, okay, fine. I mean, I don't see any reason to think they're lying. And some of the South American dictatorships have done the same thing. But this has been reported by, at this point, dozens of people. Okay. Now, people should realize it's not exactly an easy thing to talk to strangers, meaning human rights workers, journalists, especially somebody like Nicholas Kristof, you know, who's a random white guy from Oregon showing up in the West Bank and saying he works for the New York Times. Do you want to talk to me about that time a dog raped you? But you know, talking about these kinds of things is hardly easy for people who've been subjected to them. So, you know, in other words, the people that are willing to speak about it are a very, very small minority of the number of people that this has actually happened to.
Right.
I believe it was Euromed Monitor, a European human rights group, that first reported the quite literal gang rape of a woman in an Israeli prison. This woman was tied naked to a bed for 2 days, repeatedly raped by multiple different people, photographed, videoed, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, my point is, the Israeli prison system has rapidly become a place of just abject, totally unbridled sadism. Right. And that's what it is now. You know, interestingly, I remember something, I hadn't thought of this until just now, but I remember I worked very closely with a surgeon the second time I was in Gaza, named Khaled al-Ser. He's a really wonderful human being. And he was imprisoned for six or seven months by the Israelis. He was at Sedeit Tamon, if I'm remembering correctly. I'm almost positive. But when he came out, he saw a tag on a shirt that I was wearing that said Made in America. And he looked at it and he chuckled for a second. I asked him, you know, what's funny? And he said, everything in the prison was made in America. Mm. Every blanket, everything that had a label on it said Made in America. I was like, really? That's why I wouldn't have expected that. You know, it's not exactly the kind of thing you think of, but yeah, everything was made in America. Our involvement in everything the Israelis are doing is total and complete. And yeah, Hussein is among many, many, many Palestinians who are at imminent risk of death in this absolutely psychotic torture system. That's all it is, torture and murder system. And again, just to be clear, the Israelis brag about this. There's really actually no need for Palestinian testimony about this, because Itamar Ben-Gvir says these things openly. He doesn't admit to the rape and the, you know, those things, but he says, I starve them, I make sure they have unsanitary conditions, I make sure when they're released that they're physically and psychologically and broken. You know, he says, he literally brags about this in campaign speeches. Mm-hmm. So it's hardly necessary to go find additional testimony. But
I was going to say, and you mentioned Euromed Monitor. I understand that recently, mm-hmm, they were actually forced to leave Gaza because of the threats against them. by the Zionists.
Yeah, I'm not surprised by that at all. You mentioned that I've been to Palestine twice since October 7th, which is true, but I tried to go back a third time in November of 2025, and I was blocked from going in. Now, the Israelis claimed it was for security reasons, which is totally idiotic. You know, I am a male of military age, I guess, and I'm 44. But, you know, I don't speak Arabic. I have no military training, never served in the American military or any other military. So it's kind of silly. It's kind of obvious that the reason I was barred from going is because I wrote a New York Times article and because I testified at the UN Security Council.
Right.
That's it. There's obviously no other reason. In the same petition to the Israeli government that we filed at the Israeli High Court of Justice, me and several other healthcare workers, we went through some Israeli lawyers to do that. In their response to that same petition, they said that two British surgeons, one of whom is a grandmother and the other of whom I believe is a great grandfather, are such severe security risks to the state of Israel that they cannot be allowed back into the Gaza Strip to perform surgeries. It's you kind of have to laugh at how vulnerable Israel seems to be in this situation.
Right.
Afraid of a great grandfather. Wow. Yeah, it's just absurd.
Yeah. So just to wrap up, what's your advice to folks in the United States? I mean, it feels like the violence and the crimes of the Zionists are becoming so well known but somewhat normalized. People don't seem to be, you know, disturbed.
That's true, but I would, and it's not to contradict you, I don't mean it that way at all, but I wouldn't say these are crimes of the Zionists. These are our crimes.
Right.
If I say the crimes of Margaret, that implies that I, even if I'm involved, I, you know, like, people talk about we're complicit, but I hate this term. I think it's technically accurate, but it's not, I think it gives the wrong impression. If you go rob a liquor store and I help you plan the robbery and I give you a gun to carry it out, I might be complicit in your crime, but it's still your crime. If we go rob a liquor store together, I can't say I was complicit in you robbing the liquor. No, we robbed the liquor store together. We both robbed the liquor store. That's right. We both committed the crime. That's what's going on in Gaza, and not just in Gaza, but in Palestine generally, in Lebanon, right, and Iran. These are our crimes. There's a simple question. Do you think that your government has a right to force you to subsidize the murder of children? That's a very simple question. And literally 100% of people think the answer is no. There's literally no one who has any question about the answer. And anybody who doesn't know the answer to that question would be called a psychopath or a sociopath. But that's the thing. Even then, if you were to go to these people, they won't claim that they have a right to do this. They'll just claim that's not what they're doing. But it is just transparently obvious to anyone who can spend 20 minutes on the internet and has, you know, 5 functioning gray cells in their brain, it's perfectly obvious what's going on.
Right.
So what people need to do is understand a few things. Number one, your leaders have no right to do this. It's illegal under international law. It's illegal under the Constitution of the United States. And it's just illegal under every religious doctrine. It's illegal under every doctrine of moral behavior. It's completely nuts. There's no situation that makes something like genocide legitimate. Literally not. It's just outrageous. It is literally a moral outrage. So that's one thing to realize, is that this is going on. Number two, you have to realize that the reason that it's going on is not because our leaders don't know what is happening. They know full well. I actually had a meeting, this was under the Biden administration, but these things are supposed to be confidential, so I won't say exactly who, but a person who is appointed by the president to be basically the Middle East envoy, or the Gaza envoy for the administration. They reported directly to the cabinet and worked in the State Department. Now, when I talked to them, I said, because, you know, this was by like November or December of 2024, so pretty long after. And I was pretty exasperated. I said, look, I'm obviously just one person, but there are lots of people doing this. But just speaking about myself, I've written 2 open letters to the president of the United States, signed by the second one is signed by almost 100 healthcare workers who've worked in the Gaza Strip. I've written a New York Times article that was prominently published, printed in the Sunday print edition. I know every journalist who's ever covered the Middle East has read it. I have done 3 advocacy tours on Capitol Hill. I wrote an article for Politico about my time in Gaza, which I know was distributed in the State Department's own arms control export portfolio. Mm-hmm. So, like, I know that the people who make the decisions about these things have seen what I've written. And not just, again, I just emphasize, I'm one person. I know, I'm sure they've also seen what plenty of other people have written, have said, et cetera, et cetera. The, none of this is secret information, even back then. And so I asked this person, I said, how can it possibly be that our leaders at that point, Biden and Blinken and McGurk and Austin and these types of people, how can it possibly be that they don't know what Israel is doing with our weapons? And this person kind of chuckled. They said, no, they know what they're doing. I mean, like, and they actually said, they said, meaning this person I was talking to, they said, I bring up your New York Times article. I bring up your letter. I bring up your public testimonies, et cetera, all the time in the cabinet. And nobody says, oh, no, that guy's a liar. Nobody says that. They just say, yeah, I mean, he's probably right that they're killing children. He's probably right that they're starving people. But now this is me speaking. What they're basically saying is, if what American imperial control of the Middle East requires is genocide in Gaza, the complete destruction of Palestinian society, ripping South Lebanon to shreds, blowing up Iran, we weren't attacking Iran back then, but, you know, blowing up Iran, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If that's what it requires, so be it. Because we obviously have to maintain American imperial control of the Middle East, because that's a major level of world power. And, you know, the oil reserves of the Middle East are one of the greatest material prizes in human history. I'm quoting the State Department from 1945, I think. That's what's going on. It has very little to do with Zionism, or it has very little to do with the Israelis themselves. Right. It has to do with us. We are the driving force here. You know, Omer Bartov is the leading living Holocaust and genocide scholar in the world. He's an Israeli-American. He teaches at Brown. And he just wrote a very good book. I think it's called Israel, What Went Wrong, or something like that. Now, he's an Israeli, so it makes sense for him to talk about Zionism and other such things. But I haven't read the book yet. I have it on my bookshelf, but I haven't read it yet, so I apologize for that. But in interviews, what he repeatedly says is that Israel has gone completely and totally off the rails. He describes everything we just talked about. People like Ben-Gavir, Smotrich, Netanyahu, they're just crazy. He lays the blame for that, again, in interviews. I haven't read the book, but I'm sure the book has a more sophisticated argument, because it usually does. But he lays the blame for this at the feet of Zionism. He says Zionism, whatever it might have been in 1920 and 1930, has become an ethno-supremacist ideology that justifies violence at any moment, at any time, for any reason, and nothing else. Everything is violence. There's no other solution to anything. And that is obviously going to drive Israel into a total disaster. So that's what went wrong. But when he talks about the reason that that happened, he's very clear-eyed, and I think he's exactly correct. It's because the consequences of Israeli actions are not felt in Israel, because it's actually Washington, D.C. That's where the power is coming from. And so that's why I say it's like, you know, the Israelis couldn't destroy Gaza the way they've done, but the U.S. can. The Israelis couldn't destroy South Lebanon the way they have. The U.S. can. The Israelis couldn't. They literally have no physical capability to attack Iran. Only we do. Without our refueling capability, they have no ability to even hit Iran with anything other than a nuclear weapon. So all of this comes back to us. And I think that's what activists need to realize. When I give talks to people, which I do a lot. Yeah, I talk in the Bay Area churches and stuff all the time. That's where I live, east of there. A lot of the time, people say, I didn't realize how deeply involved the U.S. is. I knew how bad Gaza was. I knew what was going on was so awful. But I never realized I'm the one doing it. And that's when they realize that, like, I don't want to kill children. I don't want to kill children. Just like people are seeing ICE raids and saying, I don't want to be breaking some mom's window and dragging her through her window in front of her children that she just picked up from school just because she was born in the wrong place. That's what I would say people need to focus on, is focus on the U.S.'s role. You want to talk about Zionism, fine, do your thing. It's not a big deal. I think if we center our own agency in this is us doing these things, that's when it becomes perfectly obvious that you should be absolutely furious that your government is doing these things to people. And you should realize that there is absolutely no cause for it, and you want it to stop. And then you can get together with your neighbors, your coworkers, your congregations, whoever it might be, and you can do something about it. And there are a lot of people trying to do something about it, and you can find them. They don't have access to the mainstream media, but you can find them. And a major way of finding them is through alternative media like this program that you do. And, you know, like groups like Jewish Voice for Peace, groups like If Americans Knew, the Institute for Middle East Understanding, Students for Justice in Palestine. There's no shortage of them. So get involved.
Yeah, well, excellent advice. Rose, I really appreciate you taking so much time to talk with me today about this and for your dedication and the work that you're doing. So thank you.
No, thank you for all the work you're doing.
You've been listening to Clearing the Fog, speaking truth to expose the forces of greed. I'm Margaret Flowers. My guest today was Dr. Feroz Sidwa. We'll go out with a song by Junkyard Empire. It's called We Want.
The brothers and our sisters, the people together.